given that this was the short-lived Liz Truss government. In contrast, as the Privy Councillors knelt to render him allegiance, William peered at the Chancellor of the Exchequer and said, "Do you know, I am grown so near-sighted that I can't make out who you are. You must tell me your name, please." Apart from pens and age, William IV and Charles III have one more significant thing in common. William, as Duke of Clarence, commissioned Clarence House, Charles's London home. Like Charles, when he became king, he stayed at Clarence House instead of moving into Buckingham Palace, which he hated. Charles may have moved his office into the palace's Belgian suite, but he has absolutely no intention of making that vast, inhospitable building his home. William, who had served in the Royal Navy and was known as the Sailor King, was a rough-hewn, garrulous figure who, while genial, was no great intellect. His reign saw a significant shift in power from the king to the cabinet, and although William did not stand in the way of reform, or at least no longer than was politically wise, he earned a dubious distinction in history as the last monarch to dismiss a prime minister who still had the support of the House of Commons. William had already seen his authority weakened during the stormy passage into law of the 1832 Reform Bill. 2 years later, the issue which dominated politics was the status of the Church of Ireland. Supporters of disestablishment saw it as invidious that Irish peasants, most of whom were Catholic, had to pay tithes to a Protestant church. With the Whig government under Lord Melbourne undermined by divisions over the question, and the king increasingly of the opinion that his ministers were no longer up to the job, William decided it was time to put the ministry out of its misery, and informed Melbourne that he would not be acting fairly or honourably if he asked him to continue in office in such circumstances. Melbourne took it all very well, and was replaced by a minority Tory government under Robert Peel. Peel, who thought that the king had miscalculated, lasted just 4 months, and a humiliated William was forced to crawl back to Melbourne and ask him to form a government once more. The king's ability to make the political weather had been significantly damaged. The episode illustrates the subtle way that change occurs in the British constitution. Philip Ziegler, the Sailor King's biographer, wrote that when William dismissed Melbourne, it was felt by some that William had been unprincipled, and by many that he had been unwise. But few indeed suggested that his action had been in any way unconstitutional. After 1834, however, he never tried again. Neither did anyone else. Melbourne's dismissal was a key moment in the ever-shifting balance of power between the monarchy and the government. In the 200 years or so since then, the idea of what a constitutional monarchy is has changed fundamentally. In this audiobook, we shall survey the extraordinary political life of Queen Victoria, who exerted her will in a way that no monarch has done since, the effect that had on her son, Edward VII, and the turbulent and fascinating political times of George V. We shall examine what went on between George VI and Winston Churchill during the Second World War, and discover how Elizabeth II played a crucial role in modernising and saving the monarchy. And, finally, we shall see how the sovereign still has a political role to play today. When Sir Keir Starmer visited Donald Trump in the White House and produced from his pocket a letter from King Charles inviting Trump for a second state visit, it was a gesture that spoke volumes about the importance of the monarchy for Britain's international relations. It was also a vivid illustration of the relationship between Buckingham Palace and 10 Downing Street. Whatever Charles's views about Donald Trump, a man with whom he does not share a natural rapport, he knows how much a successful state visit can achieve, and he knows where his duty lies. My last book, Courtiers, looked at the relationship between the monarchy and the people who advise them. This book is about the relationship between the monarchy and the people who actually run the country. It seeks to understand how, without a single law being passed, Britain has gone from a country where sovereigns assumed the right to appoint the prime minister of their choice to one where they go to almost any length to distance themselves, both metaphorically and literally, from the process. It is a story of how big societal changes and